you have to take people more seriously. I think that all of the multivariate testing and all of the Kahneman and Tversky behavioral economics, it all models the end user as an idiot, like as an automaton who is just going to react to impulses that you fire at them. And I think, A, that's like a horrible way to exist in the world, conceiving of people like that. And B, I think people are getting wise to it.
Hello, and welcome to the Generation Podcast. Today, my guest is Dan Hegarty, founder and former CEO of Habito. Dan is one of the most unique founders I've come across in fintech. In 7 short years, Dan built Habito into the most recognizable mortgage brand in the UK. Fast forward to today, and Dan has now founded Communion, a savings app that aims to fundamentally change the nation's relationship with money. In this episode, we discuss his 3-step process to building a differentiated brand, how he surprisingly found channel market fit with TV campaigns, and why fintech's obsession with automation is hurting people's relationship with saving. So let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Dan. Hi, Dan. Good to see you again.
Hello, Max. Lovely to see you too.
I caught up with Izzy the other day, your head of comms, and we remembered we tried like 5 times to try and get you to speak at a Finimize event over the years and just never quite made it happen. So I'm glad the stars have finally aligned.
I would have rushed there in an instant. This was held back from me. We'll never have missed it.
Well, I remember at the time I was always fascinated with your Habito brand. Like, how does this startup with these grotesque, stylized monsters manage to become one of the most recognized real estate brands in the UK? And that's really where I want to start. So if I can set the scene for us, we're here in 2024. Fintech and finance brands have never been more boring, and everyone is chasing the algorithm. The dominance of performance marketing, product experimentation culture means everyone is copying each other and reverting to the mean. It's just created this really boring, vanilla, undifferentiated set of options for consumers. But you don't do that. Both Habito and Communion, you've invested from the start at creating a very differentiated brand. So let's dig into why that is a little bit, because founders normally hate spending on brand, especially early stage founders. So why do you invest in it so early on?
So I think there's a couple of things. So first, just to add to what you're saying, I think that the advent of generative AI is only going to accentuate the mediocrity of everything forever from now on. So we may look back on 2024 as halcyon days of human creativity. But the answer is twofold. I think one is I think ultimately a frustrated creative. You can see all the stuff behind me, like I'm obviously doing the wrong job. But two, it came from necessity. So Habito was founded back in 2014, and we did exactly what everybody does. We started with too much Facebook advertising, too much Google PPC, horrific CAC, and we're staring at some really problematic unit economics that weren't going to be sustainable with the business to survive. So we sort of knew that we had to be brave, we had to do something different, and we felt that our real core advantage in the mortgage market where we were was that it was just a fundamentally important product to lots of people. It wasn't ancillary or a nice to have. Most people at some level, like it's right there in Maslow's pyramid, care deeply about shelter, and the idea of home ownership is a powerful one. So we felt like if we could tune into that in a very real way, that there was a chance to have outsized cut through for the amount of budget and reach that we had. As such, that was the bet that we decided to make, that if we really lent all the way in to the pain of mortgages and found the right creative partner who could be brave with us, that we could make a splash in the world. I guess we did.
Yeah, you certainly did. It was a very differentiated position, especially for a real estate brand. But I'm curious how you do that well. Do you have a bit of a playbook or a process that you follow? Because it's quite easy to do something different that's not very good. Yeah. It's quite hard to do something that's different and is good.
Yeah, so I think if I'd sort of break it into a few steps that I guess to some degree I'm repeating now at Communion, I think the first and probably the most important is that you have to find a human truth. So not something hypothetical that you would like to be true, not something aspirational about the way that you would like the market to become, but something that is like viscerally and recognizably true for a lot of people and clearly your customers right now. That's the first step. And again, for mortgages, it was that it feels like hell. Like it feels like you're being robbed, you're having your time wasted, you're confused, anxious, the whole thing. So that was quite easy to discover. The second and maybe the hardest thing I think as a founder is you need to get uncomfortable. So being a founder is a generally uncomfortable position, and you're, you know, somewhat of a mad fantasist trying to convince the world that you're a CEO of your imaginary company with your imaginary products. And there can be an urge to fit in and for your brand to look like the other brands, you know, and everyone's looking at the Stripe website, now it's the Linear website, and trying to make sure that their product looks like the others so they can feel confident that customers will understand it. But we are just so inundated with mediocrity in our everyday lives and so overwhelmed by marketing messages that if you're comfortable with the thing you're putting in the world, then no one else is going to notice it. So you have to find an edge to it. And now, as you say, that edge can go completely the wrong way. So it can either be kind of lame or disinteresting or offensive and problematic. And that's why step one is the most important. So you need to find the human truth that is recognizable, that shows that you're not just showing off or sort of courting problematic press or anything like that, but there's a human truth there. And then find an edge to it that makes you feel uncomfortable enough that other people will notice it. And then lastly, number three, I guess for me, is you've got to make a big enough bet. So the agencies will all be telling you, you know, you can spend 10K, 20K, 30K, whatever it is on direct response, cable, daytime TV or whatever. That may be fine for your brand and every product is different. And I shouldn't speak universally on that topic, but there is a sort of a minimum entry fee for finding out if creative works in any specific vertical channel, particularly if you're going to be trying to do television or radio. So make sure you meet that minimum buy-in or you won't get a clear read on whether your thing worked or not. Like, you may just kind of fall under the radar of the critical mass of human attention. So yeah, make sure you've got enough cash to lose and enough cash to find out if your idea was the right one.
It seems like your philosophy is based as a founder on being brave, right? Like, you just mentioned, it's important to root everything you do in customer truth. Once you have that, you then have to be bold and trust your creatives. So I'm curious how you start to bring that to life. Do you have any examples of this specifically at Habito? And how do you know when it's working? How are you measuring that ROI?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the original scamps of the first TV ad, which I think was someone having their spine ripped out and their gold tooth pulled out by a mortgage. And I thought, my main concern was I thought it was juvenile. I was like, people are going to think this is daft and we're asking them to trust us with the most important financial transaction of their lives and all of their personal data. And we're like, around with cartoons. And that I did. I was really nervous. And this one thing I would say here is, like, bravery is often a team sport. And I remember, like, cornering our VP marketing and CMO at the time and being like, are you sure? Because I'm not sure at all. I wish I could take all of the credit for the bravery. But just, yeah, it sort of, we all looked each other in the eye and we're like, no, listen, necessity is the mother of invention. And we don't have another idea right now. And spending more on Facebook is clearly not the answer. So you make the bet. But I also think, and I should be careful not to generalize, but I think given that so many founders come from consultancy backgrounds or engineering backgrounds or product management backgrounds, there is often an urge to kind of multivariate test everything to death. And that, like, if we just run enough tests that we can acquire certainty at small scale before we actually risk humiliating ourselves or killing the business. And my experience of multivariate testing, although incredibly useful at conversion funnel optimization and lots of little things, it's not going to work for this. You're not going to be able to focus group your way through it. At some point, you are going to have to take a big gulp and make a leap of creative bravery if the rest of the world is going to notice that something happened.
And then how are you measuring that the world has noticed? Because I guess the reason that founders won't invest so heavily in brand is, like, it's expensive. It's expensive to do it well. And then when you bring it to life, often it's difficult to connect the dots between revenue growth. How have you done that in the past? And do you have any examples where, you know, you have or haven't seen the ROI come through from investing so heavily in brand?
Yeah. So the thing that I don't always mention about the Habito story is it was our second try TV campaign. And so we did a TV campaign about 6 or 9 months previous to the successful one, the Hell or Habito campaign, which was about algorithms. It was like a very beautifully animated thing about how our algorithm was the cleverest algorithm for finding your mortgage. And I remember being very excited. And I can't remember what we spent, but it was like a lot, like £50,000 on television, which to us was like a meaningful sum of money. And I remember, like, we had the spot times. We knew when it was going to be on these channels. And I'm watching all of the dashboards waiting for the spike. And it was like a mill pond. Like, it was nothing. It was as if the advert had never happened.
And you're in Habito hell.
We were. I was in my own Habito creative hell. And that felt pretty bad. And, like, we'd kind of messed it up. And there, I think it's because we'd gone for a product truth and tried to tell everybody how clever we are or were, and nobody cared how clever we are because it didn't relate to their experience of mortgages. So when we went back to the drawing board and we did it again, we saw the spike when the spots came through, and they were big spikes. And not to get too sort of dull econometrics guy on it, the thing that you would really see is you would run these campaigns for a few weeks and you'd be very, very busy because you're front of mind, you know, salient, good brand recall, all that kind of stuff. And then at the end of it, what you would see is the traffic would drop away, but you would have a new baseline. So, and every time you ran one of these campaigns, the baseline sort of accretively became higher and higher and higher. So we were able to sort of look back and do the arithmetic and figure out that this were, you know, even though the CAC just in those 2 weeks maybe didn't look good, that on a blended basis, it looked really, really good. And then to take the example of the Hell or Habito campaign, yeah, I think we halved our customer acquisition cost and tripled the size of the business.
That's incredible, because it's so easy to fall into the trap of mediocrity, especially when you're trying to be creative, right? You're trying to bring as many opinions in as possible and you end up reverting to the mean. But then being bold enough to place a large enough bet to see that pay off, how did it feel when it actually worked?
I didn't trust it. Like, I just kept finding ways to say the denominator of the arithmetic was wrong, or maybe that was, you know, something else we'd done. So no, I remained suspicious and difficult throughout the whole process. I think it was only 2 or 3 years into the journey where I was like, oh wow. And actually, when we did the grown-up econometric analysis, we found out that 80% of all of our volume was being driven by television. And actually, ironically, we were underinvesting in television compared to what it was doing for us. Now, look, that was a B2C fintech in a specific space. That is not going to be a universal playbook. But I think you can abstract the kind of the conceptual piece of bravery and cutthroat. It doesn't need to be TV. It can be social. It can be any number of channels. But you've got to make yourself unignorable in the world. And that requires both bravery and good creative partnership. You're going to have to find some people who can see where the edges are in the world that you might exploit.
I love that. You've got to make yourself unignorable in the world. What a great mantra for anyone trying to build a brand. Now, coming on to Communion, we spoke briefly last week about your partnership with Uncommon, who are arguably like the hottest agency in London right now. It's amazing that you guys are partnered from such an early stage, and again, speaks volumes to your belief in brand and rooting it in customer truths. And we'll come on to that a bit more later, but you referenced when you were talking through that relationship the importance of giving creatives enough freedom. What do you mean by that? And what did that process look like when you were working on the new Communion brand?
I think it's a general truth that there is a level of stricture that just doesn't work for wild thinkers. And that's universal. It's beyond advertising. I once had a tattoo where I let the guy do whatever he wanted. Best tattoo I ever had. Like, the more time you spend like trying to like be like, I want it to look like this, and showing him 19 photos of different things, like, you're just killing it for them. Like, you're ruining, like, the whole point is that.
And you're not a tattoo designer, to continue with the analogy, right?
I'm certainly not a tattoo designer. And so my view is a universe of infinite optionality can be overwhelming, even for the most creative people. So you've got to put some rails in and help them figure out both the customer truth and strategic truth. But then, man, like, you've got to get out of the way. Like, what do you know? What do I know? And I do think you have to trust your taste to some degree, or if you really, really don't have that in you, which some don't, some founders I know, they just don't see it as their gift, then you got to find someone really strong who you do trust in the CMO role or the VP marketing role. And it's funny, man, like, you're just seeing it. And we were very fortunate with Uncommon that we were their founding client. So in a way, we were two startups who sort of grew in parallel over a number of years. And so obviously when I was going back to the beginning with Communion, we were super excited to like go through that journey together. And I think there were many things they found very frustrating about Habito because they turned up a few years in and were like, God, your logo's so shit. We always wanted to redesign that. And so with Communion, they did. They got to sort of have creative input on absolutely every aspect of the business. It's a snowball rolling down a hill. Like, the more creative ownership they feel in the business, and the more they can see their own creative fingerprints on the work that's being generated, like, the more excited they are about doing the next thing and so on and so on.
Fantastic. I love it. And what a lesson for other founders trying to work with creatives, to be able to give up that control. I'm going to shift gear now, and we're going to talk a little bit about growth and scaling. So when you're building a challenger brand, I'm really interested in the differences between, you know, how you scale a company like Habito to over 500,000, like, what do those hundreds of thousands of customers look like versus Communion scaling its first 1,000? So let's start with what channels worked for you with Habito and any examples where you really cracked something. I know we've spoken about TV, which is completely unconventional. I don't know if I'll ever have another startup founder come on here and talk about TV. And they're normally terrified of it as a growth channel. But what are some of the keys to really cracking TV, and then any other channels that you found accelerating in that scale-up phase of the business?
So this is a bit geeky, but I think it is interesting. I don't hear people talk about it that much, is activation window. So if you take something like Habito is an extreme on this, which is that most of the time, most people don't need a mortgage. We used to estimate there's only ever maybe 300,000 people in the UK who were literally in market right now. Whereas for something like a Monzo card, like, everybody's always in market for a Monzo for their first. Everyone's got one now, but back when they were launching, you kind of got zero activation costs. Like, why wouldn't you add this lovely new card to your wallet and this wonderful new product? And I think that does drive channel selection to a degree, whereas we didn't need someone to be able to click through to Habito point of receiving the message, because most people didn't need to click through and it would have been a waste of their time. What we needed them to do was remember, so that 6 months, 12 months, 24 months later, when they did come into market, we had the highest brand recognition, so when they went to Google it, they would find us. Communion is completely the other way around, more similar to a Monzo, where anyone can activate at zero cost with our product, and we need to create the smallest window, if you like, between receiving the message, emotionally resonating with the message, and installing the application and getting on with it. And I think that we completely misunderstood in Habito. So we're like hammering away on performance marketing, trying to drive people to a website for a product they don't need today. And eventually we figured out that we needed to invert that pattern. Whereas, yeah, I think Communion is more similar to other B2C apps where it's like, come now, do the thing, you'll feel better, and then stay with us and go on this journey.
Well, I think I'm fascinated by this sort of activation window that you're talking about because it's so relevant to investing as well. On the previous episode, I was talking to Barclays managing director about how long it takes to build a relationship for something like an investment portfolio, which I imagine is similar to a mortgage. It's a large sum of money. It's a big life decision. You probably think about it at most once a year, once every few years. But you need to stay top of mind throughout that journey. So can you talk to us a little bit more and perhaps with an example of what does that look like? What is that activation window? And what are some of the activities that would pay off from investing in there?
Yeah, so I think you've got a couple of roads to that. So there's the sort of more classical CRM model. So just using mortgage as the example. So if you're on a 2-year fixed rate, really there's not much to talk to you about for the 21 months until you need to do it next. But you've got to find a reason to stay engaged. So little things that we did was we would monitor your mortgage balance and let you know, you know, if we saw that you were overpaying, we would show that the curve had steepened and so on. So we sort of deepened that association, if you like, between us and the underlying product and deepened the commoditization of the underlying product. So it was like you had your mortgage with Habito, not really with HSBC or Barclays in the mind of the customer. But really, and this is a bit of a boring answer, but it was the best predictor of retention. So the best predictor of us getting your next mortgage, your remortgage, was always a net promoter score. So you just got to do a fucking amazing job on the first one. And then they're like, of course I'll do it. Why wouldn't I? Like, no one wants to fill in that form again. So you had a really good chance, as long as you did a brilliant job, that they would stay with you. So that's the sort of the inside the product. And then outside the product, it's just that. It's good old unprompted brand recognition, where they're seeing you around. And that was another key thing of the Habito strategy, was we found out that all of that sort of cheap direct response TV, like the cheap end of TV, did nothing for us. I think we were actually one of the first brands who bought individual spots. We didn't buy by weight or in bulk. And it was Champions League final, Love Island, I forget what it was, Bake Off BBC. But we were trying to, like, whatever the largest viewership spots were. So we were actually not on TV that often, but we were absolutely hammering the moments that mattered. And I think, again, depending on your brand and the demography of your customer group and whether you need to build trust. And then that's a really interesting point, trust, right? Is that we could be really outrageous in the advertising because we were in an expensive ad slot. Do you know what I mean? So if you're doing something outrageous on daytime TV, it all looks a bit cheap and wobbly. But if it's the Champions League final, you're like, oh, well, it must be okay. So there's all of these unconscious associations that allow people to build trust and increase the probability of retaining and staying with you for that next mortgage or that next investment or that next important software purchase or whatever it might be.
That's awesome. And again, just so impressed that the boldness that you have to go with for that to pay off. If I switch focus to Communion, what's the playbook for your first 1,000 customers? Because I imagine you're not on Champions League final ads or Love Island ads.
No, not quite. Not quite yet. Although we did manage to get, thanks to our friends at Uncommon, we did manage to get Spencer Matthews to be in our launch video.
There you go.
being abused, actually, by the... We were swearing at him and it said in big letters, effing Spencer Matthews, which...
So that's the playbook for startups to copy.
Get yourself a celeb, abuse him, put it on the internet. No, it's completely the opposite. No, we're pre-seed business, no budget. But the playbook is the same, right? And for us, the human truth of Communion is a somewhat radical one, which is that we don't believe that the problem is that people don't understand compound interest or aren't investing in the right products. Like, we believe that there is a fundamental anxiety at the very basis of the relationship with money that stops people being able to think about money rationally. So leads them to impulse purchase or put their head in the sand about financial planning. So when we talked to our audience for Communion, we were completely new channel for me, actually, is 90% of our first 1,000 customers were acquired via TikTok. And by far and away, somewhat to my embarrassment, my successful ad was me talking into the phone and just saying, Sky Sports is trying to steal your money. Beyonce is trying to steal your money. Fairly confrontational message about how difficult it is to survive in late capitalism and how absolutely overwhelming the klaxon calls to consume are all the time. And that the first thing you're going to have to do is like introspect, understand yourselves and build, if you like, some sort of armor if you're going to resist all those marketing messages. And that really, really landed for us. And we were trying a bunch of stuff that was much more rational, like save every day and things will be great, or get a great interest rate with communion. And that just all like flowed down the river and no one cared about it. But when we found that emotional truth, which I think you're seeing in a bunch of different areas, you know, with parents' paranoia about phone use and all this stuff, I would think it's the same underlying thing, which is we are in an unnatural state of consumption and we feel overwhelmed by it and we want to find solutions. And it's funny, my first instinct was like, let's make a really cool advert and put it on TikTok. And I did try that and it really, really didn't work. So you have to respect your medium and also understand that your medium confers a trust or a lack of trust in the same way as television does, and think about the implications of that for your brand.
But is that message that you sort of said resonated? You believe that, right?
I believe very deeply. Yeah.
So talk to me about that and what you've sort of learned. You know, why do you believe that so deeply? And, you know, why is it important that consumers feel the sense that their money is being taken from them by all of these other things that are vying for their attention?
Embarrassingly, I'm like a fintech dinosaur. Like, I've been doing this for nearly, building consumer fintechs for nearly 20 years in the UK and investing in a bunch of them as well. And it's funny, right? Like, I really thought I was doing generally a good thing. All the same buzzwords were like democratizing access to X and removing the friction of getting a mortgage and making pricing more transparent. And I do think we did all of those things, whether it was us or TransferWise or Monzo. I think it's been a slew of great businesses who've done that. But there is a bit of an engineer's perspective on that, which is like, we'll just remove all the friction, we'll correct the market inefficiency, whatever it might be. We'll automate all those, you know, ineffective people in the call center away, all of the sort of megalomaniacal tech founder narratives that come out. But they do all fundamentally ignore the human. And I think that was what really landed for me as I sort of transitioned out of Habito, was like, oh, we've done all of this. But whenever I talk to people about their financial lives, they seem more anxious and upset than ever. They don't seem like all these products that we invested so much of our time and money in really solved the issue. So I really sat down with the team here and we read everything and we did hundreds of customer discovery interviews. That was the thing that really came out. It wasn't that people were worried that they didn't have the optimal ROI on their savings, or that they didn't understand the difference between what an ISA or an ETF was or anything like that. It was that they felt like they couldn't save, that was an impossible thing, and that saving wasn't for them. And when you really dug down further into it, it was that they were experiencing like real, like pit of the stomach money anxiety on a daily basis, particularly the sort of 20 to 40 year old segment, and felt deep shame about that. It wasn't the kind of thing they were like sharing with their friends and family, you know, the way they might their relationship woes. But that really presented itself very clearly to me as an opportunity, not even beyond for building a company, but that if we could somewhat reduce the level of anxiety and the individuals and start to fix that relationship with money, I think that there are all of these second order benefits in terms of them making great decisions about money, enjoying the things that they spend money on more.
I'd love to talk about that for a moment, because we're 10, I guess in your instance, 20 years into this democratization of finance. Savings, have we really made a dent in that? Are people really more saving more? Are people really investing more? And the tried methods of sort of goal setting and roundups and financial literacy just don't seem to have worked. And particularly through all of the research we've done, you know, really engaging with our community to try and understand, you know, what are those blockers and barriers? Actually, when it came to investing, like the rainy day fund was the biggest barrier to entry for anyone to invest. So like these concepts are very simple, but we've managed to create an atmosphere. There is so much guilt. People feel stupid. People feel like they want to put their head in the sand around the concept of saving. And that actually the act of saving seems completely insurmountable now, to the point where people just don't start. What is the industry getting wrong here, in your opinion?
So we're going to get a bit philosophical here, Max. So I believe that one of the fundamental problems of technology as a solution is that it tends to promote passivity in the end user. So there is a general like, just watch the next video on YouTube, or let the thing round up your change and then auto invest it into a basket of ETFs or whatever it is. There is a general like, in the interest of efficiency and productivity, we are going to take away work from the end user. And always the story is to free you up to do creative stuff and spend more time with your family. And I think sadly, the truth is it's to free you up to consume more, watch more advertising and spend more money to feed the machine. But that's a conversation for another day. But I think in saving that, you really, really see the problem is that the further the active relationship with money, and I mean, even like the physical relationship with money, first it turned into a plastic card. Now that even that plastic card's gone, And now it's like a thing that flies through the air from the end of your phone, like magic. And all of the very basic building blocks of the brain, like we're not built to understand that level of abstraction in exchange and bartering and so on. So I really, and we live this in a quite literal way in communion, like I think that the relationship has to be active. So at communion, every single day, we all save a pound. That is the primitive of the app. Everyone comes in, they drag a pound. They can see that everybody else has saved a pound as well. And if they're on streaks and all that kind of stuff, and they'll consume a sort of a meditation on the psychology of money altogether. And that sounds sort of like, what, like a pound? Is that enough? That seems like a sort of trivial amount. You're going to make them do that every day? That sounds awful. That's an enormous amount of friction to do something that is very easily automatable. But the reality is that like we are what we do. And if you once a day, even unconsciously in that moment for the minute that you spend in the app or even the 10 seconds you spend in the app are like, oh, I'm a saver. Like I'm a person who saved today. So when that marketing message comes at you being like, no, it's time for you to spend, you are able to resist it because you have built that resilience in terms of your own identity. So I'm a huge believer in that. And I think it becomes a little bit more complex around investing. And I agree, these sort of waterfalls of like, well, you can't do X until you've done Y. It's only people who've done X who are going to tell you that. Like it's only people with emergency funds saying you definitely need one. And listen, and I'm be cautious not to blather on, but I very much understand the urge of people. You know, we've lived in this very low interest rate environment for 5 to 10 years, and you're hearing that everybody else is becoming a millionaire on crypto and meme stocks. Of course, you don't want to stick your money into, you know, tracker. Of course, you want to take like a big swing with a massive asymmetric upside. But that isn't ultimately the best thing for most people. And I think sort of trying to balance the fact that the best thing you can do with your money is incredibly boring and won't give you a load of dopamine with the fact that you need to make it an active thing that they engage with daily, that is a real puzzle. I think the challenge is balancing the need for dopamine and active engagement and excitement that people want and why they conflate gambling and investing with the need for an active saving habit that isn't something that's happening to the user, but it's something that the end user is doing for themselves.
Well, I think, you know, for us talking about investing, this is the message that we give to all financial institutions right now, is we need to stop thinking of ourselves and our role as teachers and advisors. Because anyone that's got kids or runs a team, you try and tell them what to do, it's never going to happen. And a lot of that is because if someone tells you what to do and you say, oh, okay, I'll do that then, you've got no autonomy to explore what to do next and to go on your own self-discovery journey. Whereas if you allow people to go on that journey and provide some contextual nudges and let them make their own mistakes and then come up with their own solutions to that, then they've got a framework and a foundation to build upon. Someone tells you to do something and it doesn't work. If it does work, you also have got nothing. So we're completely, completely there with you on that. So we spent some time on the philosophical to bring it back down to something quite practical. What would your advice be to banks and platforms to try and get more people to save?
So this is a challenging one because I think that these platforms, by their very nature, are trying to sell a lot of products simultaneously. And that is partially because they've got high customer acquisition costs. They need to generate lots of revenue to offset the amount of money they spent acquiring the customer. But I do think ultimately that it is the overwhelming number of options that is a part of the challenge and part of the overwhelm that these end users experience. So I think partially my unhelpful advice is just try and do less. Stop trying to flog them Palladium and this coin and that coin, and be honest about what you think is actually beneficial for them and do a good job of selling that to them, which is tough advice. And I think you have to take people more seriously. I think that all of the multivariate testing and all of the Kahneman and Tversky behavioral economics, it all models the end user as an idiot, like as an automaton who is just going to react to impulses that you fire at them. And I think A, that's like a fucking horrible way to exist in the world, conceiving of people like that. And B, I think people are getting wise to it. And I think there is I think just in the same way that, you know, we're more media savvy than our parents were and understand the internet. I think that when I speak to my niece and nephew and a lot of the communion customers, they are just much more thoughtful about the way that they are consuming. And actually, I'm straying philosophical, but their identity is defined by what they don't consume more than what they do consume. Like veganism being an example, like I'm a person who doesn't do that rather than I'm an American Express customer, which would have been my parents' generation. Like they're happy because they did do that. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I think this idea of sort of stripping everything back, and essentially there's only so much real estate. I remember you told me this last week, there's only so much real estate and surface area that you have when you're engaging with a customer. So the more you cram in is more noise, more playing into anxiety, more overwhelmment, and more likely that people just duck out of that whole process.
Totally. I mean, and you know, and I say this with all the love in the world, love Monzo, love TS and Tom and the team, phenomenal people, but like that app's a problem now. between, it's trying to like do a lot of things, trying to monitor my mortgage and sell me a flex thing and a premium card. All good wealthy products, I think they show a lot of respect to the customer. But even there, like very smart people trying to sell products that are actually reasonable and that people might want to use. I can't navigate the app anymore, and I've been using it for how long it's existed. So I think you've got to be honest with yourself about what you're doing, and this sort of ruthless single-mindedness of trying to generate long-term customer value means stripping some of that stuff out.
And how are you going to defend against that at Communion? It's very easy to be sort of narrow and on day one when you've got a small customer base and you're solving a clear need, but Series D, E, F, beyond, you have investors to appease.
Do you know, so the big thing, and this is going to sound reductive, it's all about acquisition costs to me. So the second you let those balloon, and every founder does it, they're like, oh, it's okay because we'll cross-sell X and we've got this product Y coming. You've got to find a way to sustainably acquire a lot of people at reasonable cost, or you will never have control over your products, and you will keep hoping for the best with the new launches and cramming everything in every nook and cranny of the front of the iPhone. So I think that's number one. So how do you do that is a different question. But again, for something like Communion, like the member get member mechanics, customer referrals are totally fundamental. And that, again, requires the product to be something that people understand and feel is good for them, or they won't recommend it, which again, I think is a good discipline for a builder.
Totally. And perhaps indicates a bit of what marketers and product builders can expect in the future, a bit of a reversion to organic tactics, brand tactics becoming more powerful than this whole reversion to the mean and performance. So as we're coming to the end of this now, Dan, I'd like to finish all of these episodes talking about leadership. You know, you've scaled a successful brand, you launched another cool startup, you're very happy to go back and throw yourself in at the deep end of hand-to-hand combat. But what's your biggest lesson that you're taking with you into this new challenge that you have, but also the biggest lesson that you want other leaders to take away? Like, what makes a great leader?
That's a big one. So to avoid trotting out the usual stuff, the thing that really struck me, two things. I was a very insecure founder, and I think a lot of the founders I talk to are pretty insecure because there has to be something like a bit wrong with you to like want to do this and to like be sort of confused enough about your self-worth that you think everyone is going to want to come along with you.
Delusions of grandeur, comfortable with the uncomfortable.
It's delusions of grandeur. Exactly. So, but that comes with it, like the insecurity that makes you need to do that with your life also means that you spend a lot of time looking at all the other products and all the other founders and shit, like they're going quicker and they're already in the US or whatever it might be. And I definitely found that led me to a sort of a combination of intellectual promiscuity and greed. I wanted to do everything all the time. And so, there were, you know, at Habito, I look back on it, like there was a point where we were building a mortgage broker, a mortgage lender, but a whole life insurance business, not a broker. We took all of that simultaneously. And I broke our leadership team. Like I literally broke their minds as well as my own. And I think if there's anything that I took from it, and everybody talks about focus, and people often talk about focus as a binary, you're either focused or you're unfocused. And that's not true. It's definitely a gradient. And I think that the cost of parallelization, of attention, of splitting your focus of your team in multiple directions, people massively, massively underestimate the cost of that. Because you've got all these people who are sort of rotating through all of these different priorities. And trying to get them all to line up, even for a moment, is very, very challenging and creates a bunch of politics and friction and discomfort in the organization. So if there's anything that I would have taken from what I've learned to date, it is that serialization is the answer. Do one thing at a time. It feels terrible because you're like, oh God, but what about priority 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6? But if you can bring your whole organization and your full attention and energy to bear on a single problem, you can get it done really quick. And then you can move on to the next thing together. It requires real, real internal discipline and like the amazing kind of people that I've had the good fortune to work with. And it goes against all of my natural instincts, but I've just again and again over the last 5 years, it's turned out to be the right thing.
Is that something that you work on consistently with yourself? Is that easier now you've, you know, got some experience and had some success?
Yeah, I definitely, I self-report to my team quite frequently. I'm like, I've got a bad idea. I'm thinking about pressuring you into doing it. Like I'm getting it off my chest. So you've got to set up some guardrails for yourself. Every negative is a positive, right? Like you're a visionary and you're a fantasist. And one is lauded and one is incredibly dangerous. And they're partially post facto decided which one you are, depending on how successful you are. But I think it is really just important to know thyself.
What a fantastic way to end this episode, to know thyself. But for sure, look, I've loved this conversation. Dan, I've got so much respect for you as an entrepreneur. I'm going to take this away, but I'm sure many of our listeners will too, about being bold as a point of differentiation, really listening to the customers, but ultimately just keeping things simple.
Listen, it was a huge pleasure, Max. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. See you soon.